The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, by Robert A. Carroll. Part 1. Continued. These were years when the frontier, the edge of settlement in central Texas, was terrible in its isolation, separated as it was by hundreds of miles from the state's more populated areas near the Louisiana and Arkansas borders. Families which moved to the edge of settlement in the 1830s and 40s and 50s, says Texas historian T.R. Fehrenbach, left 19th-century civilization far behind. And because central Texas was the hunting ground of the Apaches and the fierce Penetaka Comanches, masters of human torture, it was, in Fehrenbach's words, a genuine frontier of war. Men who went and took their families to the edge of settlement had to be driven or lured by big dreams indeed. Each farmer who did so, Fehrenbach says, did so yearning for his own small kingdom, willing to suffer hardships beyond counting while he carved it out with his own hands. The Buntons went to the very edge. John Wheeler Bunton, the hero, came from a wealthy family in Tennessee but wanted something more and went west to Texas, then after the war with Mexico moved west within Texas, then west again. His first homestead was on the plains below Brenham, when those plains were the edge of the frontier. About 1840, despite the hammer blows of the Apaches and Penetacas, the frontier edged west to the Colorado River. Bunton, about 1840, moved beyond the Colorado, settling near Bastrop. During the 1850s, settlers pushed about 50 miles farther west to the 98th meridian, where the plains ended in the Texas Hill Country, a highland known to geologists as the Edwards Plateau, began. And along that meridian, Fehrenbach says, for two decades, the frontier wavered, now forward, now back, locked in bitter battle. During 1858 and 1859, two of the bloodiest years in Texas history, the dead of that frontier would be numbered in the hundreds. In the isolated log cabins that dotted the hills, settlers huddled in fear during the nights of the full moon, the Comanche moon. But during the 1850s, near the 98th meridian, in the plains at the edge of the hill country, John Bunton built not a cabin, but a graceful two-story plantation house with three verandas, surrounded by cotton fields and pastures in which grazed not only sheep and cattle, but the finest Tennessee thoroughbreds, and staffed with Negro slaves dressed in black trousers and white waistcoats, the great plantation of which he had dreamed. And although Indians still roamed the area, twice his wife, in his absence, scared off threatening bands with a rifle. When a log cabin church was founded in nearby Mountain City in 1857, the Buntons would arrive at it on Sundays in an elegant sulky driven by an elderly retainer named Uncle Ranch. The Bunton plantation, named Rancho Rambouillet after a French breed of sheep John was trying to raise there, may have been the westernmost cotton plantation and plantation house on such a scale in all Texas. West and west and west again, pursuing a big dream. John was not the only Bunton who took that course. So did the three brothers who followed him to Texas, one of whom, Robert Holmes Bunton, a large, impressive man, standing 6 feet and 3 inches in height, and weighing about 260 pounds, with fair skin, coal-black hair, and piercing eyes, was Lyndon Johnson's great-grandfather. Very little is known about Robert Bunton. He first moved from Tennessee to Kentucky, where he became a substantial planter. Nevertheless, in 1858, at the age of 40, he moved to Texas, near Bastrop. And then he, too, moved west, to Lockhart in the plains just below the hill country. He fought in the Lost Cause, as did his sons and six grandsons, all of whom, a family historian noted, were over 6 feet tall, enlisting as a private and within a year being promoted twice, to sergeant and lieutenant. After the war, he raised cattle and sent them up the Chisholm Trail to Abilene. Huge herds raised on a huge ranch, for with the profits of each drive, he bought more land. Dreamers of big dreams, the Buntons were also, to an extent somewhat unusual among Texas frontier families, interested in ideas and abstractions. John Bunton was one of the founders of the short-lived Philosophical Society of Texas, which was formed in 1837 to explore topics of interest which our new and rising republic unfolds to the philosopher, the scholar, and the man of the world. No such details exist about Robert, but his descendants recall hearing that he had a reputation for being absolutely truthful and an excellent conversationalist, and greatly interested in government and politics. If in his old age he found someone at Weinheimer's store to talk with when he went shopping, he would sit and talk all day and into the night, although, unlike most of those with whom he talked, he preferred to discuss not practical politics, but theories of government. He was regarded by the other men, says a descendant of one of them, as an idealist. Idealists, romantics, dreamers of big dreams, though they may have been, there was nonetheless a hard, tough, practical side to the Buntons. Neighbors remember them as canny traders, and remember, too, their favorite saying, "Charity begins at home." And while their dreams were big, in the face of necessity, they had the strength to scale them down, to adapt to reality. The dreams of John Wheeler Bunton proved too big for the land to support. Cotton could not be grown profitably enough in central Texas to support a huge, elegant plantation, and the showy French sheep didn't produce enough wool or mutton. But he experimented with new breeds, and although he lost some of the thousands of acres Rancho Rambouillet had originally covered, he held on to enough so that he died, leaving a handsome estate to his son, Desha. Desha drove cattle north and, making money, bought large tracts of land near Austin. When cattle driving turned unprofitable, he had to sell those tracts, but he managed to hold on to what he had started with. He held on to it and turned it into a farm. Its hogs, if cattle weren't profitable, the Buntons would raise an animal that was, producing sausage that he sold in Austin, acquiring as he did so a reputation as a hard, shrewd businessman. As late as 1930, Desha's son and daughter were running the same ranch their hero grandfather had left, and the hero's house still stood. The Buntons were very proud people, a neighbor recalls. They had elegant parties in that beautiful yard. They were really striking the way they looked, tall and straight. Their ears were big and their noses, and they had those piercing Bunton eyes. And although during the Depression they were forced to sell off first one piece and then another, they held on grimly to as much as possible, so that as late as 1981, more than a century after its founding, the ranch, reduced to perhaps 200 acres, was still in the family. Robert Holmes Bunton, Lyndon Johnson's great-grandfather, sent big herds up to Abilene with his sons. Cattle prices began to fall, and from one drive his sons returned all but penniless. Then, together with another brother, Robert mustered up a herd of 1,500 head and sent them up the trail with one of the brother's sons. The young man returned home without a dime, having apparently fallen into the hands of card sharps in Abilene. Robert, it is related, said not one word of reproach. But while other men persisted in making drives that grew steadily less profitable, the two Bunton brothers all but stopped raising cattle themselves and instead rented out their pastures as grazing land for herds from South Texas that were passing through and needed to rest for a few days on the way north. Many of the men who owned those herds made no money from them, but the Buntons did. Robert Bunton made enough so that he was able to retire comfortably and to give his six children a start in life when they married. Money to his daughters, one of whom, Eliza Bunton, was Lyndon Johnson's grandmother, and land to his sons. And the sons made successes of their land, one becoming one of the biggest ranchers in the big ranch country of West Texas. The Buntons, then, while never as successful as they had dreamed of becoming, were more successful than the run of ranchers in central Texas. In a land in which economic survival was very difficult, they survived. Central Texans often judged their neighbors by whether or not they left something for their children. The Buntons left something for theirs, and the children made something out of what they were left. It was only when, in Lyndon Johnson's father, the Bunton strain became mixed with the Johnson strain, that the Bunton temper and pride, ambition and dreams, and interest in ideas and abstractions brought disaster. For the Johnsons were not only also dreamers, romantics, and idealists, not only had a fierce pride and flaring temper of their own, and physical characteristics which greatly resembled those of the Buntons, they also resembled the Buntons in their passion for ideas and abstraction, without resembling them at all in shrewdness and toughness. They had all of the impractical side of the Buntons, and none of the practical side. Big as were the Buntons' dreams, moreover, the Johnsons' dreams were even bigger. Their dreams lured them beyond even that far point to which the Buntons had ventured. The Buntons stopped just before the edge of the hill country. The Johnsons pushed forward into its heart. And the hill country was hard on dreams. The hill country was a trap baited with grass. To men who had lived in the damp, windless forests of Alabama or East Texas, and then had trudged across 250 miles of featureless Texas plains, walking for hours alongside their wagons across the flat land toward a low rise, and then, when they reached the top of the rise, seeing before them just more flatness, until at the top of one rise they saw in the distance something different, a low line that, as they toiled toward it, gradually became hills, hills stretching across the entire horizon. To these men, the hills were beautiful. From the crest of the first ones they climbed, they could see that this wasn't an isolated line of higher ground, but the beginning of a different kind of country. From that crest, range after range of hills rolled away into the distance. And from every new hill they climbed, the hills stretched farther away. According to these early settlers, every time they thought they were seeing the last range of hills, there would be another crest. And when they climbed it, they would see more ranges ahead, until the hills seemed endless. The hill country, they said, was a land of false horizons. They were, in fact, at the eastern edge of a highland that covered 24,000 square miles. The air of the highland was drier and clearer than the air on the plains below. It felt clean and cool on the skin. The sky in that clear air was a blue so brilliant that one of the early settlers called it a sapphire sky. Beneath that sky the leaves of Spanish oaks, ancient and huge, and of elms and cedars, sparkled in the sun. The leaves of the trees in the hills looked different from the leaves of the scattered trees on the plains below, where the settlers' wagons still stood. A darker, lush green, a green with depths and cool shadows. Beneath the trees, the hill country was carpeted with wild flowers. In the spring, bluebonnets, buttercups, the golden burgundy Indian paintbrush, and the white-flowered wild plum. In fall, the golden eye, and the golden mane, and the golden evening primrose. And in the fall, the sugar maples and sumac blazed red in the valleys. Springs gushed out of the hillsides, and streams ran through the hills. Springs that formed deep, cold holes. Streams that raced cool and clear over gravel and sand and white rock. Streams lined so thickly with willows and sycamores and tall cypresses that they seemed to be running through a shadowy tunnel of dark leaves. The streams had cut the hills into a thousand shapes. After crossing 250 miles of flat sameness, these men had suddenly found a landscape that was new at every turn. And the streams, these men discovered, were full of fish. The hills were full of game. There were, to their experienced eyes, all the sign of bear, and you didn't need sign to know about the deer. They were so numerous that when riders crested a hill, a whole herd might leap away in the valley below, white tails flashing. There were other white tails, too, rabbits in abundance. And as the men sat their horses, staring, flocks of wild turkeys strutted in silhouette along the ridges. Honeybees buzzed in the glades, and honey hung in the trees for the taking. Wild mustang grapes, plump and purple, hung down for making wine. Wrote one of the first men to come to the hill country, "It is a paradise." But most of all, to the men who moved into it first, the hill country was beautiful because of its grass. These first settlers were not southern aristocrats or substantial planters. Substantial planters had money to buy good, easily accessible land and slaves to work it. When they came to Texas, they settled on the rich river bottoms of the coastal plains. By 1850, they had recreated a southern plantation economy, complete with mansions, near the Gulf. The men who came to the hill country were not from the plantation south, but from the hill and forest sections of the south. They were small farmers, and they were poor. These were the men who had fled the furnishing merchant, who furnished the farmer with supplies and clothing for the year on credit, and the crop lien, which the merchant took on the farmer's cotton to make sure he paid out the debt. And they had fled the eroded, gullied, worn-out, used-up land of the Old South that would not let them grow enough cotton or graze enough livestock ever to pay it out. Land was something these men and their families had to live off. And that was why the grass of the hill country was what filled their eye. These were the men who had come farther even than the Buntons. Their numbers were small. Thousands of rural southern families heard the news of San Jacinto in 1836, took one last look at their eroded, exhausted soil, chalked GTT on their gates, and headed for a new land and a new start. In 1846, statehood, which had been pushed by the new president, increased the flood of migration. Tens of thousands of southern families painted Polk and Texas on their wagon canvas and headed down the plank roads of the south, through its weary towns, as bystanders cheered, and westward across the Mississippi and the Sabine into Texas. In 1837, the population of Texas was 40,000. In 1847, it was 140,000. By 1860, it would be 600,000. But the flood crested near the Sabine and flowed south toward the Gulf. Most of the newcomers settled in the piney woods of East Texas and the coastal plains. Only a shallow stream flowed west across the 250 miles of prairie blacklands, and by the time the stream reached the Edwards Plateau in the center of Texas, at whose edge the Buntons stopped, it was no more than a trickle, and only a very thin trickle indeed climbed up into the hills. Although Austin, almost on the plateau's edge, was the state capital, it was still a frontier town. In 1850, people were still being killed on its outskirts, and its population was only 600. Beyond, in the hill country, the dreaded Comanches ruled, and during this era the population of the typical hill country county is counted not in thousands or in hundreds, but in scores. The cabins became more distant, separated by miles and miles, Fehrenbach has written, and the settlements significantly were no longer called towns, but forts. If the lights in the eastern Texas forest by the middle of the 19th century were still few, in the middle of the state, the lights were swallowed in vastness. Trying to explain why men, often with their families, would trade civilization for terror, Fehrenbach notes that this was the part of Texas in which dreams seemed nearest to realization. A man could see far and smell winds that coursed down from Canada across 1,000 miles of plains. There was an apparently endless rolling vista north and west and south. The small woodchopper, with an axe and a couple of brawny sons, could catch a scent of landed empire and dream of possibilities to come. There were many reasons bound up with these, but whatever the reasons, whatever the dreams or fears that pulled or drove hundreds of thousands of men into Texas, few had made a journey as long or as hard as these men. But when they saw the grass, they felt the journey had been worth it. "Grass knee-high," one wrote home. "Grass as high as my stirrups," wrote another. The tall grass of the hill country stretched as far as the eye could see, covering valleys and hillsides alike. It was so high that a man couldn't see the roots or the bottoms of the big oaks. Their dark trunks seemed to be rising out of a rippling, pale green sea. There was almost no brush and few small trees, only the big oaks and the grass, as if the hill country were a landscaped park. But a park wasn't what these men thought of when they saw the grass of the hill country. To these men the grass was proof that their dreams would come true. In country where grass grew like that, cotton would surely grow tall, and cattle fat, and men rich. In country where grass grew like that, they thought, anything would grow. How could they know about the grass? The grass had grown not over a season, but over centuries. It wouldn't have grown at all had it not been for fire. Prairie fires set by lightning and driven by wind across tens of thousands of acres, and fires set by Indians to stampede game into their ambushes or over cliffs. For fire clears the land of underbrush, relentless enemy of grass. The roots of brush are merciless, spreading and seeking out all available moisture, and so are the leaves of brush, which cast on grass the shade that kills it. So if brush and grass are left alone in a field, the grass will be destroyed by the brush. But grass grows much faster than brush, so fire gives grass the head start it needs to survive. After a fire, grass would re-enter the burned-over land first. One good rain, and among the ashes would be new green shoots. And by the time the brush arrived, the grass would be thick and strong enough to stand it off. even with the aid of fire, the grass had grown slowly, agonizingly slowly. Some years most of it died, some years all, but in other years it grew, and after a while it had a base to grow in, for even in the years when most of it died, some residue remained. This base built up gradually until there was, at last, atop the soil, a padding to protect the soil from rain and add to the fertility with which it fed the next growth of grass. At first a thin pad, and then a thicker one, and finally a lush, diverse carpet in which could grow the big grass, the stirrup-high grass that dominated the beautiful hill country meadows that the first settlers saw. The big grass had big roots. Every time fire came to help it, natural fire or Indian set, it grew back faster. As it got taller, it grew faster still, for it held more and more moisture and thus could survive dry spells better. But even so, it had taken a very long time to grow. It had grown so slowly because the soil beneath it was so thin. The hill country was limestone country, and while the mineral richness of limestone makes the soil produced by its crumbling very fertile, the hardness of limestone makes it produce that soil slowly. There was only a narrow thin layer of soil atop the hill country limestone, a layer as fragile as it was fertile, vulnerable to rain and wind, and especially vulnerable because it lay not on level ground but on hillsides. Rain running down hillsides washes the soil on those slopes away. The very hills that made the hill country so picturesque also made it a country in which it was difficult for soil to hold. The grass of the hill country, then, was rich only because it had had centuries in which to build up, centuries in which nothing had disturbed it. It was rich only because it was virgin, and it could be virgin only once. The hill country was a trap baited with water. The men toiling toward that country saw the hills as a low line on the horizon. There was another line in the same place, right along those first ridges, in fact, but the men couldn't see that line. It was invisible. It was a line that would be drawn only on maps, and it wasn't drawn on any map then, and wouldn't be for another 50 years. But the line was there, and it would determine their fate. There were clues to tell them it was there. Some of the first men to enter the hill country noted the remarkable resemblance of a small shrub they found there to the tall walnut trees of the Atlantic coast they had left behind them. Even its nuts were similar, except, of course, they were so much smaller. No larger, one early observer wrote, than a musket ball. There was a reason the little shrub resembled the big walnut tree. It was the tree, the tall tree shrunken into a small bush. Some of the settlers commented on bushes they found along the streams of the hill country, bushes which looked exactly like the mulberry bushes along the streams and rivers in the Old South, except that they were a quarter the size. There were many other trees and shrubs that resembled, in miniature, trees and shrubs in the states from which the settlers had come. There were other clues. The way the settlers' campfires burned so brightly in the hill country. Because the wood in this new country was so dense and hard. The way the branches of even living trees were so rigid that they snapped at a touch. The stiffness and smallness of the leaves. Even the somber darkness of their green. The darkness that added so much to the beauty of the hill country. And in the fields of the hill country there was, all but hidden in the tall grass, a rather large amount of a plant whose presence was surprising in such a lush, rich land. Cactus. There were plenty of clues, plenty of warnings, to tell the settlers the line was there, but none of the settlers understood them. The line was an isohyet, from the Greek, isos, equal, and hyatos, rain, a line drawn on a map so that all points along it have equal rainfall. This particular isohyet showed the westernmost limits in the United States along which the annual rainfall averages 30 inches, and a rainfall of 30 inches, when combined with two other factors, rate of evaporation, very high in the hill country, and seasonal distribution of rainfall, very uneven in the hill country, since most of it comes in spring or autumn thunder showers, is the bare minimum needed to grow crops successfully. Even this amount of rainfall, especially with its irregular seasonal distribution, is, the United States Department of Agriculture would later state, too low for that purpose. East of that line, in other words, farmers could prosper. West of it, they couldn't. And when, in the 20th century, meteorologists began charting isohyets, they would draw the crucial 30-inch isohyet along the 98th meridian, almost exactly the border of the hill country. At the very moment in which settlers entered that country in pursuit of their dream, they unknowingly crossed a line which made the realization of that dream impossible. And since rainfall diminishes quite rapidly westward, with every step they took into the hill country, the dream became more impossible still. Agricultural experts would later understand the line's significance. There is a well-defined division between the fertile east and the arid western regions of Texas, one expert would write in 1905. An average line of change can be traced across the state, approximately where the annual rainfall diminishes to below 30 inches or near the 98th meridian. That line, another expert could say in 1921, runs down the entire United States. The United States may be divided into an eastern half and a western half, characterized, broadly speaking, one by a sufficient and the other by an insufficient amount of rainfall for the successful production of crops by ordinary farming methods. Historians, too, would come to understand it. One would sum up the hill country simply as west of 98, west of 30 inches of rain. The Western historian Walter Prescott Webb says that the line amounts to an institutional fault, comparable to a geological fault, at which the ways of life and living changed. But this understanding would come later, much later. At the time the hill country was being settled, there was no understanding at all, not of the climatic conditions, and certainly not of their consequences. When people first crossed this line, as Webb states, they did not immediately realize the imperceptible change that had taken place in their environment, nor, more as the tragedy, did they foresee the full consequences which that change was to bring in their own characters and in their modes of life. This lack of understanding was demonstrated during the years leading up to the Civil War, when North and South argued over whether or not to prohibit slavery in areas that included western Texas and New Mexico. In all this sound and fury, as Fehrenbach points out, there was no real understanding that slavery, based on cotton agriculture, had reached its natural limits. It had no future west of the 98th meridian. Where the Edwards Plateau began in Texas, the rainfall and the plantation system of the 19th century South abruptly ended. From the middle of the state, on a line almost even with Austin, the rainfall dribbled away from 30 inches annually to 15 or less across the vast plateaus. The farm line halted in crippled agony. The trap was baited by man as well as by nature. The government of Texas, eager to encourage immigration to strengthen the Indian-riddled frontier, plastered the South with billboards proclaiming Texas advantages, and was joined in boosterism by the state's press. In an overstatement that nonetheless has some truth in it, Fehrenbach writes that there was almost a conspiracy to conceal the fact that in the West there was little water and rain. Official pressure even caused regions where rainfall was 15 inches annually to be described as less humid in reports and geography books. The term arid was angrily avoided. Boosterism was just as strong in the hill country. George Wilkins Kendall, who began sheep ranching there in 1857, was soon trying to sell off land in Blanco County by firing off enthusiastic letters to the New Orleans Picayune, exhorting others to follow his example. Those who failed in the venture, notes a hill country resident, were called Kendall's victims. But when the first settlers came to the hill country, no one was calling them victims, least of all themselves. If someone had told them the truth, in fact, they might not have listened, for the trap was baited well. Who, entering this land after a rainy April, when the springs are flowing, the streams are rushing, the live oaks spread green canopies, and the field flowers wave in widespread beauty, would believe it was not in a less humid, but an arid zone? Moreover, as to the adequacy of rainfall, the evidence of the settlers' own eyes was often misleading, for one aspect of the trap was especially convincing, and especially cruel. Meteorologists would later conclude that rainfall over the entire Edwards Plateau, is characterized by the most irregular and dramatic cycles. Even modern meteorology cannot fathom their mysteries. In the 1950s, during a searing, parching dry spell that lasted for 7 consecutive years, the United States Weather Bureau would confess that it had been unable to find any logical rhythm in hill country weather. Just when the cycle seems sure enough for planning, nature makes one of her erratic moves in the other direction. Rain can be plentiful in the hill country, not just for 1 year, but for 2 or 3 or more in a row. Men, even cautious men, therefore, could arrive during a wet cycle and conclude, and write home confidently, that rainfall was adequate, even abundant. And when suddenly the cycle shifted, and the shift could be very sudden, during the 1950s it rained 41 inches 1 year, 11 the next, who could blame these men for being sure that the dry spell was an aberration, that it would surely rain the next year, or the next? It had to, they felt. There was plenty of rain in the hill country. Hadn't they seen it with their own eyes? The first settlers did not realize they were crossing a significant line. They came into the new land blithely. After all those years in which they had feared their fate was poverty, they saw at last the glimmerings of a new hope. But in reality, from the moment they first decided to settle in this new land, their fate was sealed. Dreaming of cotton and cattle kingdoms, or merely of lush fields of corn and wheat, they went back to their families and brought them in, not knowing that they were bringing them into a land which would adequately support neither cattle nor cotton, nor even corn or wheat. Fleeing the crop lien and the furnishing merchant, hundreds of thousands of Southerners came to Texas. Of all those hundreds of thousands, few had come as far as these men who came to the hill country. And they had come too far. The Buntons had stopped just before the hill country. The Johnsons had headed into it to become, they boasted, the richest men in Texas. They were descended from a John Johnson. Some family historians say he was of English descent, but they don't know this for certain. The few known facts of his life, and of the life of his son, Jesse, fit the pattern of migration into newly opened, fertile land, the using up of the land, and the move west again, that underlay so much of the westward movement in America. And the Johnsons' route was the route many followed. Georgia, the most sparsely populated of the original 13 colonies, wanted settlers, particularly settlers who could shoot, and it was the most generous of the colonies in offering land to Revolutionary War veterans. The first time the name of Lyndon Johnson's great-great-grandfather, John Johnson, who was a veteran, appears in an official record is in 1795, when he was paying taxes on land in Georgia's Oglethorpe County. By his death in 1827, he owned land in 3 other counties as well, but little else. As Georgia's land wore out under repeated cotton crops, men searched for new land on which to plant it. And when, after the War of 1812, Georgia's western territories were cleared of Indians, settlers poured into them in a great migration. John's son, Jesse, who was Lyndon Johnson's great-grandfather, was part of that migration. He was a first settler of Henry County. Few facts are known about Jesse's life, but from those few it is possible to theorize about big dreams, which, unlike the dreams of the Buntons, ended in failure. For a time, for example, Jesse Johnson appears to have been a respected and prosperous farmer in Henry County. He served as its sheriff from 1822 to 1835, and also as a judge. But by 1838 he was no longer living in Henry County. He and his wife Lucy and their 10 children had moved west again, into Alabama. There, in the records of Randolph County, appear again hints of transient success. The 1840 census lists only 2 persons in the entire county engaged in commerce, Jesse and one of his sons. A local historian guesses that they operated a stagecoach line or were in the banking business. They were prosperous. Jesse owned 17 slaves. But by 1846, Jesse was GTT, to Lockhart, on the plains near the hill country. In the Lockhart courthouse are records showing that in 1850, Jesse Johnson owned 332 acres, 250 head of cattle, and 21 horses. And there exists also a will drawn up in 1854, as if Jesse believed he was leaving a substantial estate to his family. One of its clauses, for example, provides that at his wife's death the estate is to be equally divided among his children, excepting the heirs of one who had died, who I will to have $1,000 more than my other heirs. But the reality was that there was no $1,000 more, or at all. When, after his death in 1856, his sons sold their father's assets, they didn't realize enough even to pay their father's debts. In 1858, two of them, Tom, then 22 years old, and Samuel Ely Johnson, Lyndon Johnson's grandfather, then 20, headed west into the hills, making their boast. To go into that land took courage. The Spanish and Mexicans had not dared to go. As early as 1730, they had built three presidios, or forts, in the hill country. But down from the Great Plains to the north swept the Lipan Apaches. The terror, in the words of one early commentator, of all whites and most Indians. The presidios lasted 1 year. Then the Spanish pulled out their garrisons and retreated to San Antonio, the city below the Edwards Plateau. In 1757, lured by the Apaches' protestations that they were now ready to be converted to Christianity, and by Apache hints of fabulously rich silver mines, the Spaniards built a fort and a mission deep within the hill country at San Sabah. But the Apaches had only lured the Spaniards north, because pressing down into their territory were the Comanches, who rode to war with their faces painted black and whom even the Apaches feared. They had decided to let their two foes fight each other. The Spaniards believed that Comanche territory was far to the north. Not knowing the Comanches, they didn't know that the only limit to the range of a Comanche war party was light for it to ride by or grass for its horses to feed on, and that when the grass was tall and the moon was full, Comanche warriors could range 1,000 miles. On the morning of March 16, 1758, there was a shout outside the San Sabah mission walls. Priests and soldiers looked out, and there in barbaric splendor, wearing buffalo horns and eagle plumes, stood 2,000 Comanche braves. When word of the San Sabah massacre reached San Antonio, the Spaniards sent out a punitive expedition. 600 men armed with 2 field guns and a long supply train, the greatest Spanish expedition ever mounted in Texas. Its commander chased the Comanches all the way to the Red River, and then he caught them. He lost his cannon, all his supplies, and was lucky to get back to San Antonio with the remnants of his force. And thereafter the hill country, and all central Texas, was Comancheria, a fastness into which Spanish soldiers would not venture, even in company strength. It wasn't until half a century later, in 1807, that the next attempt would be made to penetrate the hill country. A walled Spanish town, complete with houses and cattle, was built on a bluff near the present site of San Marcos. That lasted 4 years, when during the 1820s settlers from young Stephen Austin's colony in South Texas began to push up the lower Colorado River. The only traces of the town were some remnants of cattle running with the buffalo. In 1839, the dashing president-elect of the 3-year-old Republic of Texas, Mirabeau Bonaparte Lamar, hunting buffalo on the edge of the hill country, looked out to the beautiful hills and exclaimed, "This should be the seat of future empire." The capital of the new republic, Austin, was founded the next year on the spot where Lamar had stood. But Austin was still in Comanche country. From the surrounding hills, parties of mounted Penetaka Comanches watched the settlement being built. It wasn't until the 1850s that the town's slow, steady growth, combined with the success of the Republic's ranging forces, forced the Indians to retreat. Where they retreated to was the hill country. This was their stronghold. Writes a Texas historian, "They lived along the clear streams in the wooded valleys, venturing out to raid the white settlements and ambushing any who were hardy enough to follow them into the hills." But men followed them, even as Austin was being built, pushing beyond it into this country which Spanish soldiers wouldn't enter even in force, were men who entered it alone or with their wives and children. As early as the 1840s, there were cabins in the hill country. After Texas became one of the United States in 1846, border defense became a federal responsibility. the United States Army established a north-south line of forts in Texas, about 75 miles deep in the hill country. But these forts were scattered, and their garrisons were tiny. They were ill-equipped with horses. At the time the forts were built, the Army did not even have a formal cavalry branch, and some of the first troops sent out to fight the fleet Comanches were infantry mounted on mules. For some years, moreover, they were not permitted to pursue Indians. They could fight only if attacked, which made them all but useless against the hit-and-run Indian raiders. But they did provide a little encouragement for settlement, and a little encouragement was all these men needed. Behind the fort line, Americans crept slowly up the valleys of the hill country. By 1853, there were 36 families along the Blanco River and 34 along the Pedernales. This was the very edge of the frontier. These families had left civilization as far behind as safety. Their homes were log cabins, generally small and shabby cabins, too. Shocked travelers found conditions in Texas rougher and more primitive than in other states. One traveler, just from the States, directed to a certain home in the Blanco Valley, thought as he neared it that it must be one of the outhouses. Inside, however, he found 8 people living, in a single room 14 by 16 feet. Outhouses were, as a matter of fact, not common in the hill country. Said Frederick Law Olmsted, who traveled through it in 1857, "It would appear that water closets are of recent introduction in Texas." He told of staying at one house where there was no other water closet than the back of a bush or the broad prairie. The home of the ordinary hill country family, often set in a fire-blackened clearing still dotted with tree stumps, was a dog run. 2 separate rooms or cabins connected under a continuous roof, with an open corridor left between for ventilation. The dog run acquired its name, Fehrenbach notes, from its most popular use. The corridor was hardly the most sanitary of spots. The walls of these cabins, visitors complained, were so full of holes that they did little to keep the wind out. Rutherford Hayes wrote that he slept in one through whose walls a cat could be hurled at random. The cabins were surrounded with tools, plows, pigs, and hungry hounds. There were few amenities. This life, Fehrenbach says, was hardy, dirty, terribly monotonous, lonely, and damagingly narrow. Few of the Americans who later eulogized it would care to relive it. The only thing plentiful was terror. This frontier was, for 40 years, a frontier of continual war. Indian wars raged for decades in many states, Fehrenbach notes, but there was a difference to the Anglo frontier in Texas that colored the whole struggle, that imbued it with virulent bitterness rare in any time or place. The Anglo frontier in Texas was not a frontier of traders, trappers, and soldiers, as in most other states. It was a frontier of farming families, with women and small children, encroaching and colliding with a long-ranging, barbaric, war-making race. Remington paintings, lines of mounted men charging on horseback, came to life on that frontier. The first battle in which Texas Rangers were armed with the new Colt revolver, which was to equalize warfare with the Comanches. Previously, one of these savage Cossacks of the plains could charge 300 yards and shoot 20 arrows in the time it took a frontiersman to reload his single-shot rifle. Took place in 1842 on the Pedernales. Captain Jack Hayes's Rangers routed the Comanches, whose war chief said, "I will never again fight Jack Hayes, who has a shot for every finger on his hand." As late as 1849, at least 149 white men, women, and children, the figures are incomplete, were killed on the Texas frontier. During a 2-year period, a decade later, hundreds died. And those who died were luckier than those who were captured. This book is continued on cassette number 2, side 1.